He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad, oh, he got all of that one.
Oh my gosh.
That is amazing.
Layup with an iron into the hazard.
Oh my God, you had to deal with the golf course people too!
Well, that wasn't quite what I meant, you know?
Welcome into another edition of the 73rd Hole. Colby Powell and Taylor Williams with you as always. Scott Tway will be joining us today. Younger brother of Bob Tway, won the 1986 PGA. He was on Bob's bag for a long time on the PGA Tour, and then he spent more than a decade on Scott for Plank's bag. It's a couple years with Chris Kirk, and now he's with Brian Harman. So we look forward to talking to Scott. Want to remind everyone, get on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, search 73rd Hole, and you will find us on those three platforms. Make sure you follow us there. Reach out to us. Let us know what you think of the show. Make sure to rate and subscribe wherever you may be listening. We would certainly appreciate it. Thanks to all of our guests that have joined us and have made this kind of off-season for golf, this unexpected off-season, a blast for Taylor and I. So without further ado, we're happy to welcome Scott Tway to the program now. And Scott, we appreciate you joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're glad you could join us. And, you know, I kind of always usually start by asking people how they got started in the game of golf. I think our listeners can probably guess, based on your last name, that, you know, golf kind of runs in your blood and it runs in your family. But just kind of take us through your upbringing and how golf was a part of your childhood. And then as you got to become a collegiate player and then onto the PGA Tour as a caddy.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because, you know, most people think that my dad must have been, you know, a pretty good golfer or what have you. And actually, he didn't start playing golf until he married my mom. And it was my grandfather who was a pretty active player around Oklahoma City. He was just an amateur, but he really enjoyed playing. He was a good athlete, good player. And he got my dad into it, and he just fell in love with it. So we moved to Missouri when I was about 4 years old, and because he wanted to play golf a lot, and on the weekends, he kind of started a junior program there, and we got into it, and he really supported us in that. So, you know, we've been playing Bob and myself, you know, from a very early age. So it's been part of our life, you know, as long as I can remember.
And how much older is Bob than you are?
Bob is 5.5 years older.
Okay. So,
we never really competed against each other much, but certainly have played a lot of golf together over the years.
I was going to ask, I was wondering how close you were in age, because I was wondering if you got to play any high school or junior tournaments or things against each other. But what was it like having your older brother, who obviously was a great player, major champion, be that much older than you and kind of helping you as you were coming up?
Well, it was great. Well, I remember most is he'd usually get out of some bad bets I'd make. I can remember losing money on the putting green, and he'd win it back for me.
That's awesome.
But he was great. I mean, you know, as a kid, to have a brother like him, having the success that he has, and being as good a brother as he was, you know, he was kind of my hero growing up. I mean, I remember we were living in Atlanta at the time, and I was about, I don't know, I was probably 12 or 13, and he's going to a Hawks game, Atlanta Hawks game, and he's taking me down there, you know, as a 17-year-old when most guys weren't doing that for their little brothers. So he's always looking out for me, and it's been great. So to actually, you know, have the chance to caddy for him on tour was, you know, made it even better.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really cool that, you know, you guys have been able to have such a great brother-brother relationship. You know, you hear a lot of times about the older brother will kind of pick on the younger brother and give him a hard time a lot of times. So that's really good that he was able to be there and be encouraged for you, Scott, for sure. And so, you know, kind of what was it like, you know, kind of going on both sides of the spectrum, you know, what was it like seeing, you know, your brother Bob have such, you know, success, you know, looking up, he got all the way up to number 5 in the world, which is an incredible accomplishment right about the same time that he holed out of the bunker to beat Greg Norman at Inverness in 86 PGA, one of the most famous shots in all of golf. So kind of for yourself, what was it like growing up, kind of watching him going through his success while at the same time you were trying to, you know, get your game to the level that you wanted it to be?
Yeah, well, first of all, it was great. I mean, you know, it's exciting to see your family member have such great success. And, you know, I mean, you walk to the club and people are talking about your brother. As a matter of fact, I was trying to qualify when he won the PGA, 86. I was trying to qualify. It finished on a Monday because they had a rain delay. And I was playing at Atlanta Athletic Club in the U.S. Amateur qualifying. So I didn't actually get to watch most of the day, but I finished my round. And I go into the men's grill, and, you know, all my buddies who I grew up playing golf, you know, who were also out there trying to qualify, were all sitting in the grill and watching it on television. So I get in there, and I'm watching it. I watch the last four holes with all these guys that, you know, I've known for years. And for that to happen, I mean, it was unbelievable. And so, you know, it was great. As far as, you know, me, did it put any more pressure on me? Did it, you know, probably a little, but, you know, at that age, you don't really think about it. I'm just out there trying to play golf and do my own thing. And so, you know, everything about it was great.
Absolutely. So tell us kind of a little bit about your playing experience, Scott. You know, what, you know, you, like you said, you were trying to qualify for the U.S. Amateur, so obviously you're a very elite player yourself. Looking up your profile, you played college golf at Georgia Southern. So kind of take us through your playing career and then how, you know, how that led you to end up getting on the tour as a caddy.
So, yeah, so, you know, I played extensive junior golf and was good enough to, you know, I started out at Georgia Tech when they were kind of redoing their program. So it was early on, you know, before the days of Stuart Sink and Duvall and some of those guys. But, you know, the program was really turning around and it really wasn't for me. So I ended up transferring down to Georgia Southern, but, and played a lot of amateur golf. And then I played a little bit of professional golf on the mini tours and I got into the club business for a little while. And so I played the club pro series down in Florida some, and, you know, some club pro stuff, but, you know, didn't have much of a pro career really. I was just, you know, trying to make my way, make a living and play at the same time. And so I really didn't have, you know, I wasn't going to make a plan. And so I was, you know, I had caddied for Bob through the years growing up. I mean, I caddied for him when he was still in college. I caddied for him at the State Open in Georgia when he beat Tim Simpson, which was pretty exciting, and he was still an amateur. And caddied for him one summer on the TPS tour, which was kind of it was early web.com tour, you know, kind of, it wasn't really sanctioned by the tour, but it was kind of supported by the tour. And so, you know, I've caddied for him a lot over the years, so it was just kind of a natural thing when he asked me to come out and caddy for him. I mean, it was a no-brainer for me, so very excited to have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, and I know that your first victory on the bag was in 1995, and it was on Bob's bag at the 1995 Heritage Classic. So what was that like, being on the bag with your brother for a PGA Tour win, your first as a caddy? Just take us through kind of that Sunday, the tournament down the stretch, and then kind of the emotions whenever it was over.
Yeah, so, you know, people ask me, what's your favorite victory? And that's really the one that I tell people, just because, number one, it was the first, but the situation really, because Bob kind of went through, you know, a little bit of a, I don't know, you call it a slump or a downtime. You know, he'd been trying to make some changes to his swing in the, you know, in the constant battle to get better. And so when I started caddying for him, and so he was really fighting to get back to where he was, and it's been, well, it was, I believe it was 90 was the last win before that win at Hilton Head in 95. So it's been a 5-year stretch for him. So for him to work his way back and get in the winner's circle there at the Heritage, which, you know, it's kind of it's almost a local tournament, us, you know, growing up in Atlanta for us. But it was pretty exciting because he started the day. We finished 2 hours before the last group, and he shot 5 under. And anybody who knows Hilton Head, you know, on the last day, the conditions out there can get pretty tough and people can start backing up. And so to shoot five under and post a score, you know, we really didn't think that we'd probably have a chance, but you never know out there. And sure enough, you know, the wind picked up and guys kind of started faltering a little bit. And next thing you know, we're in a playoff with Nolan Henke and let's see, who was the other guy? Can't believe I can't pull it. David Frost. So what was interesting was David Frost got knocked. We went to the 18th hole and David Frost got knocked out on the first when he made bogey. So we go back to the 17th, which is a par three. And it's now it's just Bob and Nolan. And Bob, during regulation, had kind of flared. You know, there's water down the left side, so you can't hit a left. And he kind of flared one almost into the grandstand and had an incredibly difficult chip. And he holed it.
Oh, my.
And then, yeah, so, you know, that was kind of the shot that really got him into the playoffs. So then we go back there. Second hole of the playoff, and he's first to hit, same club, same shot, and he hit it in there about 4 feet behind the hole. And then Nolan had to hit next, and he hit it in the bunker, chipped it out, missed a 10-footer. So Bob had a 4-footer that he could two-putt to win the tournament. And I'll never forget it because, you know, he's obviously he's going to lag it. And he's putting with this old-style bullseye, you know, that's just the flat blade. So he puts it down there and stops about 2 inches from the hole. And he walks up to it, and it was like slow motion in a movie because I can see what's happening. And he just reaches up, and he backhands it right into the hole. You know, just taps it in with the backside of the putter. And he didn't even realize he did it. But I'm sitting there going, oh, no. You know, but, of course, it went right in the hole, and it was all good.
Yeah, that's, you know, go ahead, Scott. Sorry.
Yeah, well, just very special. You know, after it was done, and, you know, I'm walking over, I'm going to, you know, give him a big hug and jump into his arms or something like that. And he kind of looks away, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to let him have his time. And he came up to me later and he said, hey, Scotty, he goes, I'm sorry. If I had looked at you right then, I was going to lose it. So it was very emotional, to say the least, because, you know, it was a long time coming. So very exciting.
Yes, definitely long time coming there. And that you know, that would be the one time that you would want to, you know, maybe not to get too fancy with the way that you're trying to make a putt in by doing it backhanded. But that does make for a great story, Scott. And so kind of during that playoff and kind of towards the final few holes of that tournament, you know, we talked to players, you know, and obviously they get nervous coming down the stretch. And we had Taylor Gooch's caddy, Mel Baker, on a couple weeks ago. And he talks about, you know, the fact that caddies get nervous just as players do. So during the final, you know, because you mentioned you teed off 2 holes before or finished or 2 hours before. Leaders were able to get in. So, you know, kind of were you kind of towards the end of that round, were you getting nervous yourself thinking, oh man, we might actually have a chance here? Was it kind of more laid back? And then, you know, what were you feeling personally going into that playoff? You know, were you super zoned in, just ready to go? Did you feel nerves because you were kind of out of control and just kind of had to watch the shots? You know, kind of what was going through your head through all this?
Well, so that was kind of nice. That's the nice thing about coming from behind and walking into a situation like that, because no, there was no nervousness in regulation, you know, coming down. You're just trying to shoot as low as you can, not really thinking that you're going to have an opportunity to win the tournament. So there was no pressure of, like, you know, trying to hold on to a lead or anything like that. We were just trying to get in as low as we could. And then sat around for 2 hours waiting, you know, just waiting and watching. And so obviously, you know, in a time span like that, you know, there's going to be, you know, a little bit of anticipation and excitement and, you know, thinking about the possibilities or whatever as it gets closer and closer and you think you might have a chance. As far as, and we're going back quite a few years now, so as far as what I was feeling when we got into the playoff, I don't really remember. You know, it was exciting. I was really happy to be there. And the one thing that's good about a playoff is that you've already been out there and played the course
and played those holes. So the decision making isn't really that big a deal, and especially if you're executing. So, you know, you go back to the 18th hole, and sure, you're nervous, you're excited, the anticipation, but it's a driver. And so there's no decisions to be made. And then, you know, you go and that second shot is such a difficult shot, you're just trying to get it on the green. And so he was able to do that and make a par. And then we go back to 17, and we knew what the club was. We knew what the shot was. It was just a matter of executing. And he hadn't executed the first time, and he did it the second time. So, you know, it was – there wasn't a whole lot to, you know, I don't know. I'm sure that I was very nervous, but it just kind of happened. And that's the way it does a lot of times. You know, you never know when it's going to come, and you don't expect it, but you sure are happy when it does.
Right, exactly. Probably a lot of different emotion. You know, kind of like you said, y'all didn't expect to be in that position, you know, so maybe a little bit of a shock, you know, excitement for the opportunity, and also nervousness kind of all on top of that. So I bet it was a whirlwind of emotions, to say the least, Scott. And, you know, we'll get on to some of the other great players that you've been able to caddy for over the course of your career. But I want to address something with your brother that I thought was very interesting. Looking back on kind of some of his career and his success, I saw that he won PGA Tour Player of the Year back in 1986, like we mentioned earlier, same year that he beat Greg Norman. And so I was scrolling down and I looked, trying to figure out, you know, how many Ryder Cups he was able to play in, and I wasn't able to find any information. And I went back and looked on it, and going back, I believe that there had only been maybe two or three players ever that had won PGA Tour Player of the Year and not played on a Ryder Cup team or played in a team-type format. So has Bob ever had any, you know, type of, not necessarily regrets, but has he ever said, man, I really wish I would have been able to get on one of those teams or anything along those lines? Because, like, you know, for someone to get up to number five in the world and beat PGA Tour Player of the Year, to never make one of those teams, I found it was very interesting.
Yes, it is interesting, and I would say that it's probably the biggest, if there was a disappointment in his career, it would be that he never got the opportunity to play on one of those teams. And it's interesting because he would have made the team, you know, that year based off of points or whatever. But at that time, they had a rule that you had to be a member of the PGA of America, which the Ryder Cup, you know, obviously is run by the PGA of America. You had to be a member, a full standing member, to be eligible to play. Well, that takes 3 years, you know, back then, of playing on tour before you're considered a full member of the PGA, and that was Bob's second year. So the rule was later changed, and I believe it was changed for Tiger Woods, because he would be eligible, you know, as one of his first or second years on tour. So they changed the rule in anticipation of him playing in the Ryder Cup. And unfortunately, it didn't work out for Bob. And yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest disappointments for him in his career, is not getting that opportunity. It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, it definitely is. I didn't even realize that was a rule. And, you know, I'm glad they changed it. I wish they would have changed it sooner, because it seems like a bad rule. You go out, you qualify, you play well enough to make it, and then it's like, oh, well, it's only your second year on tour. So as a second-year tour member, we can't possibly let you into the Ryder Cup.
You just be one of the top 12 players in the world, you know, or top player in the country that you're representing. You know, that should be what gets you in. You know, I mean, I don't see why there should be a time curriculum here, you know, to get you in.
Correct. And it was a bad rule, and I think they realized that. That's why they changed it. And it may not have, you know, even come into play or been a factor up to that point. I don't really know. But that's a bad deal. And, yeah, I'm with you. I'm glad they changed it. Wish they changed it a little sooner.
And we saw something similar a couple years ago, back when they went from only two captain's picks to four captain's picks. And then they also changed the timing of the picks, because I believe it was when Billy Horschel caught fire and won the FedEx Cup, and they had already had all the picks and all the rankings solidified by that point. So they weren't able to get one of the hottest players in the world at the time on the team, because everything was already solidified at that point. So it's almost like they almost realize their problem until it's too late, which in the case happens a lot of time.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Tway joining us here on the 73rd hole. I want to remind everyone, as storm season approaches in Oklahoma, you need to have McRae Roofing on your radar. Their commitment to craft is what defines McRae Roofing and Exteriors. McRae Roofing is a locally owned and operated roofing service company that is passionate about the quality of their roof creations. Jeff McRae, owner of McRae Roofing, views your roof like a canvas. His team's sole purpose is to create you a masterpiece of a roof, which brings out the beauty of your home and its surroundings, a beauty that will last for years to come. Call McRae Roofing today at 405-692-4000 or visit them online at McRaeRoofing.com. Scott Tway with us here on the 73rd hole, currently on Brian Harmon's bag. But Scott, I know after you caddied for Bob, you ended up on another local guy here's bag for a while, Scott Verplank. What was that like being on Scotty's bag, and how much success did you all have?
Well, that was great. And we had a lot of success. And it was interesting how that came about too, because, I've been working for Bob for 10 years up to that point. And, 10 years is a long time for anybody. And then you put two brothers together and, as good as it was, at some point in time,
Decades a long time for brothers to work together. It really is.
Exactly. So we were all kind of, I remember it like it was yesterday. We just finished playing the PGA I believe it was at Valhalla. And they both missed a cut. And we were flying home on Saturday morning, and we get back to Oklahoma City, and Scotty comes over to me and he goes, "Hey, look, Bob and I were talking and nobody's having any fun. And, we're just kind of slogging along here. We're thinking of maybe switching something up to the next tournament in Reno. So what do you say, you work for me and my caddy Rich will work for Bob and we'll just, switch it up a little bit." And I'm like, "Let's do it." So, it was kind of, I think we had missed like 6 or 7 cuts in a row going into there. So things weren't going real good at the time. And so I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." I'd always kind of wanted to work for Scotty too, because he's a total different kind of competitor than Bob. Bob is very stoic and he's quiet and he's determined and driven. And Scotty gets really in, but Bob is, he's even keel all the time. You couldn't tell if he's playing good or playing bad. And Scotty he's a little more emotional, but I mean, he gets fired up. We played a couple of team events with him before I started caddying for him. And, we'd be walking off the first hole playing in a match play environment. And he's like, "Let's go out there and just beat the tar out of these guys." And I'm like, "Yes, I like that." And so I thought it'd be interesting to work for him because it was so much different than the way Bob was. So anyway, I look forward to the opportunity. We go to Reno the next week, and I'm waiting in the parking lot. And instead of going to Bob's car, I go to Scott's, and I get his clubs out, and we go play a practice round with Bob. And, it was great because we're all friends. We play golf together at Oak Tree, and, it was really no big deal.
Did you ever accidentally go over? Did you ever accidentally go over during that practice round, try to pick up Bob's bag and try to carry his? Did you ever get confused at the time because you kind of was so used to it for 10 years?
I did not, but I could definitely see how that happens. That was more when I started working for Harmon. So working for right-handers for so long, for the first few times working for a lefty, occasionally I might stand on the wrong side of the ball. But it didn't happen with the bag when working for Scott. But what was interesting was that week at Reno, Scotty won the tournament, first week that I worked for him.
Oh, that's a good omen.
Yeah, so that is really because, it just seemed, and Bob and I really didn't talk about it that much, and that's kind of the relationship we had. I mean, we really didn't need to talk about it. It was just time to do something different. So after we won that tournament, I just kept working for Scott, and it lasted for 12 years. And in that time, we had We had two Ryder Cups, two President's Cups, you know, quite a few victories, and so really good run.
Yeah, one hell of a run, to say the least. And, you know, we brought up earlier how your brother Bob, unfortunately, wasn't able to make any of the Ryder Cups, but you were able to get there as a caddy on Scott's back. So kind of what was that experience like, being in the same room as some of the other greats of the game? I can't remember exactly off the top of my head what all years you were there, but obviously, you know, Tiger, Phil, some of the other big names were there. So what was it like to be in that experience?
Yeah, there's nothing like it. You don't experience anything else like that in golf, you know, that team environment. And like you say, just kind of hanging around the locker room or the, you know, the grill or wherever you're eating or whatever. And, you know, whether it's, you know, guys playing ping pong or whatever it is, it's just fun. And the environment at a Ryder Cup is, it's hard to explain. You'll never feel energy like that anywhere else.
Now, did you get to caddy, you know, on U.S. soil and on European soil?
Unfortunately, no. Only across the pond. We played at the Belfry in England, and we played in Ireland at the K Club. So
2002 and 2006,
on foreign soil. So. Huh? What's that?
I said, I believe that was 2002 and 2006 were those 2 years.
That is correct. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, the first one was supposed to be 2001, but that it got delayed to 2002 because of the 9/11.
Yes, very unfortunate. Yeah, because I remember. Yeah, because everything the Ryder Cup used to be on the odd number of years, and President's Cup was on the even number of years. And unfortunately, such horrible tragedy, like 9/11. Because I believe the Ryder Cup was supposed to be scheduled less than a month after that, or something like that. So I mean, there would have been no possible way to have that event.
Yes, exactly. That is correct.
So how did you notice during those Ryder Cups, how did you notice, you know, maybe not his demeanor, but, you know, maybe his attitude, Scott's attitude and view towards the event? How did it change going from, you know, individual tournaments, you know, where it's mainly about yourself, you know, you're just trying to figure out the game plan for yourself, and now you're on a team, and not only are you playing for yourself, but you're playing for your teammates and also your country?
Well, he was a natural at that. I mean, you know, he won the U.S. Amateur. So he understood playing match play, and he liked the team aspect of it. You know, we had done a couple, like I said earlier, we'd done a couple of team competitions with him. So I knew, you know, how badly he wanted to, you know, he liked it, getting out there one-on-one. I'll never forget one time at the Belfry, we were playing, we were playing the singles match, I believe, and it was so it was final round. Lee Westwood, we were playing, and Scotty got off to a hot start. He started off like birdie, eagle, and was three up, three, and we get to like the fourth hole. Yeah, and we get to like the fourth hole, and he hits, you know, there's a cross bunker, and he hits his drive, and it's kind of cutting down the right rough line. So you can't really tell if it's in the fairway or if it's not. And so, you know, he's walking back to me, and I was kind of like, well, I couldn't really tell. And he goes, without missing a beat, he says, it's perfect. It's right in the fairway. And so Lee hits, and we're walking off the tee, and he tells me, he goes, I don't know where the hell it was, but I sure wanted him to think it was in the fairway. And that's the kind of mentality that he had. You know, he didn't know if that ball was in the fairway or the rough, but he wanted Lee to think that it was in the fairway. And so he was smart. And I, you know, honestly, to tell you the truth, I learned way more. And Bob told me the same thing, because I went back and caddied for Bob several times, you know, in either off weeks or on the Champions Tour. And he would tell me, he goes, you know, you're a lot better caddy now than you were before. And he was right, because I learned a lot from Scott Verplank about, you know, just game management and you know, the mental aspect of it, because he's very good at both.
Yeah, kind of go a little bit more into that aspect of it, Scott. You know, kind of what else you saw. You know, you mentioned how Scott was such a great match play player, and you know, I look at some of the other good match play players, looking at, you know, like Seve Ballesteros in the Ryder Cup. You know, he'd say he would jingle change in his pocket, you know, when the other player was trying to set up or over the ball, or you know, bend over when the player was trying to hit. You know, stuff that was really unethical, but you know, just to win the match. And then, you know, like Tiger in his book, he would say that a lot of times in match play, he would, you know, hit a 3-wood off of the tee box to be able to hit first into the green, or he would do things like, you know, make a, you know, a player would get over a putt to try to hit a 3-footer, and then he would tell them while they're over the ball that it's good. You know, just little tactics like that. Did you get anything out of that from Scott, from someone who had such a great match play experience?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I just kind of referenced one, you know, with that story about Lee, but I mean, none of the Bush League stuff, like, you know, like you're talking
like
about.
Like jingling change.
Yeah, jingling change. That's not a good deal. And I used to hear a story about Ray Floyd would undo the Velcro on his glove, like right before somebody was getting ready to hit or something. I don't know if that's true, but I think there used to be a lot of that stuff going on in the earlier days, which there's not much of that. You don't see much of it anymore. But just as far as strategy goes, you know, he was, yeah, I mean, all that kind of, the stuff he talked about with Tiger, you know, wanting to hit first into a green and, you know, making a guy think about a putt before you actually give it to him. You know, those are all things that can play into your favor, because you're basically, you know, trying to make it as hard as you possibly can on a guy. And make him feel more pressure, you know. So Scotty would use, you know, any of that kind of stuff. He definitely, you know, would take advantage of any situation if he could, as long as it was ethical.
Yeah, definitely want to do it the ethical way. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the Lee Westwood story, you know, like you said, you want the player to feel uncomfortable. So, you know, whether it's on that right line, you know, is it in the bunker, is it not? You know, we're not sure, but you want to come off with as much confidence and really swagger as you can, you know, because, you know, the opponent's going to be able to read your body language. You know, if you start, you know, kind of slouching down and getting angry, you know, my co-host over here, Colby, caddied for me in a couple of match play events, and I lost my composure at times, and he was able to tell me and was able to alert me of that. So definitely a match play. I think that was one of the things that really benefited Scott too, is being able to keep that positive mindset, body language good. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, he had that confidence, you know, of just wanting to go out there and, you know, kick everyone's tail. And, you know, I think that leads a long way, especially when you go head to head against someone.
Yeah. And Scott, like Taylor said,
right, but
go ahead.
No, that's a very good point that he made about the way you carry yourself, because, you know, it's like anything in life. If you're exuding confidence, then people are going to see that. And, you know, they're in a match play situation, you know, oftentimes they're going to be intimidated by that. So it would definitely give you an advantage.
Yeah, like my co-host here mentioned, I've caddied for him on many, many occasions. So I have a special respect for caddies and what you all do out on the tour, because I know how difficult it can be occasionally to deal with a player whenever, you know, things don't go right, or, you know, trying to get too high, too low throughout a round, things like that. So I want to take a quick break, and then I want to get into some of that stuff, talk about how you got on Brian Harman's bag, and then how you deal with kind of the emotions of different players that you've been on the bag for. So Scott Tway with us here on the 73rd hole. Don't move a muscle. We'll be right back.
When something the size of a golf ball hits your roof, you need to call McRae Roofing. McRae Roofing is Oklahoma's designer roofing service specialist. For years, Jeff McRae and the experienced team at McRae Roofing and Exteriors have served fellow Oklahomans by helping them with their roofing needs. McRae Roofing uses only top quality materials and professional crews to make sure that each job is done right, so it will give you the years of service, security, and protection you need from the unpredictable Oklahoma weather. McRae Roofing offers residential and commercial roofing, ventilation services, and custom copper designs. McRae Roofing is dedicated to exceeding the homeowner's expectations. It's not just a roof, it is your home's crowning glory. Call McRae Roofing today at 405-692-4000. That's 405-692-4000. Make sure to also visit their website at mcraeroofing.com. That's McRae Roofing.com. Don't get caught with a leaking roof. Contact McRae Roofing for your free inspection today.
Welcome back to the 73rd hole. Colby Powell and Taylor Williams with you as always. Scott Tway joining us today on the show. And Scott, one thing I'm curious about, you know, going from Scott Verplank's bag to Brian Harman's bag. I know you caddied for Chris Kirk as well. Was there was Chris Kirk after Scott Verplank before Brian Harman, or kind of what was the order thing of things, and how did you end up getting onto these couple other players' bags?
So, yeah, Chris Kirk was after Scotty V and before Brian. And that was just kind of an interesting deal because Scotty was, you know, as you know, he dealt with a lot of physical injuries and what have you. He's diabetic and he had numerous Tommy John surgeries and what have you. So at that point, it was 2012, I believe. He was a little beat up and he was taking a month off and wasn't going to play for at least a month. So, you know, I had heard through the grapevine or, you know, knew that Chris Kirk kind of ran a, you know, kind of a rotation of caddies. Didn't like to keep the same caddy all the time. He'd go on like a 3-week deal. So I knew his agent. I called him up and said, hey, I got a month off. You know, wanted to see if I could get in with Chris maybe for a few weeks. And, you know, he went over it with him, and sure enough, they gave me 3 weeks. So that started at Colonial in 2012, and I had never met the guy until the first day when we walk out of Colonial. You know, I'm just waiting for him to come out of the locker room, and we go off to the practice tee and, you know, have a conversation. How you doing? Nice to meet you. And he finished fifth in the tournament, and very, very, very talented player. And so we finished at the end of the 3 weeks that he'd given me. Scott, he's like, well, what's Scotty going to do? And I said, well, I don't know. He's not playing. So we just kept going. And Scotty was still taking time off. And so by that time, you know, it was probably about 8 weeks or so. It was getting down towards the end of the season. And Scotty really didn't know if he was going to play or not. And Kirk had already qualified for the playoffs and what have you. So he asked me, he goes, well, what are you going to do the rest of the year? And I said, well, I'm going to finish it with you. And it was just kind of natural the way it happened, because Scotty was kind of winding down and it was just an opportunity for me and I had to take it. So I finished the year out with him and then did another full season with him before he finally got tired of looking at me. And then he kind of went back into his normal routine. But I felt fortunate to make it a year and a half with the guy. That's somewhat of a record. So after we split up, you know, I was sitting around with nothing to do, just kind of waiting to see what my next deal was going to be. And that's when Harman got in touch with me. And I knew Brian from years back when he was 16. You know, he's kind of a phenom as a junior player.
Oh, he was a phenomenal junior player. I mean, I remember he was a 2- or 3-time AJGA All-American. I mean, and he went to University of Georgia. I remember me growing up as a youngster being appreciative of how, you know, he was winning, like I said, every AJGA event that he came to. And what year was it, Scott, that you got connected with Brian again?
Well, I started with him in 14. Well, so it would have been the fall of 2013. But it was the start of the 2014 season. So we already had gotten into the wraparound season by then. But I met him when he was 16. We go back to the Heritage. He won the Players Amateur. And back then they gave the winner of the Players Amateur a spot in the Hilton Head Tournament. And he was 16 when he won it. And so he was... Mike Holder was trying to recruit him, and he was in Hilton Head actually caddying for Bob, and I was caddying for Verplank. So Brian played a practice round with us and when he was 16, and that's the first time I ever met him. And then, I don't know, 10 years later or so, I started working for him. So it was kind of crazy.
That's a really cool story. And that's a nice recruiting tool for Holder to get in as a caddy and play in the same group as a player that he's trying to recruit. That might have gave him a little bit of a little bit more convincing and a little bit more recruiting prowess, I guess, if you would. But it wasn't enough to get him up there, unfortunately. But my next question for you, Scott, would be, you've gone through so many great players here, you know, Bob, Scott, Kirk, and now with Brian Harmon. And, you know, you don't have to get into each one of them personally by any stretch of the imagination, you know. But for yourself, what is it like going through to, you know, to different personalities, and how are you able to relate with them? You know, like last week we had Steve Ball, one of the best swing instructors in Oklahoma, on our show, and he said essentially the magic sauce between an instructor and a student is being able to get that relationship, not only through their skill level, but also on a personality standpoint. You know, so what was it like for you going from these different types of individuals to figure out what works best for them in their game? You know, when to give them advice, when not to, when, you know, whenever they have a, you know, a bad shot, when to leave them be, when to pump them up, stuff like that. You know, what was it like for yourself having to adjust to all these things?
Yeah, well, I think that's the whole niche, really. You know, I mean, to me, caddying is much more about relationships than it is, you know, your ability to give a yardage. And so, you know, it's knowing those little things, you know, when to say something, when not to say something. And that's just a matter of being able to, you know, so I've worked for basically four different guys through 30 years, and all four of them are completely different personalities, every single one of them. And so, you know, any caddy that's starting out new with a player, I mean, that's basically what you're trying to do initially, is figure out who they are, what they need, and, you know, what you can do. So that's where the old adage about, you know, show up, keep up, and shut up, is there's a lot of truth to it. And the reason why that saying was so prominent back in the day and really isn't today is because early on PGA Tour, you know, caddies were rotating all the time. So, you know, guys were waiting in the parking lot and they might pick up a different guy every week. So you really didn't know. So if you were going to survive, it was a good idea to keep your mouth shut and just pay attention. And so for me, early on in a relationship with a player, that's what you better do if you want to last. You better keep your mouth shut, listen to what they have to say, try and find out what they need from you. Because it's not about what you want, it's about what they want and what they need. And if you're able to provide that for them, then you're going to get along. So, you know, that's kind of been what I do. And the further you get into it, you know, then it becomes a little more complex, but at least, you know, you're not making mistakes.
So is that felt like you is that how you handled like the Chris Kirk situation, Scott? You know, someone, and it's a little different, you know, like your brother, and then you had known Verplank for many years. Now you're going over to someone who, like you mentioned, you had never met before. You know, you introduced yourself on the day that you're doing it. So is that kind of how you handled that? You know, you just kind of sat back, observed, kind of saw his tendencies, things like that. So you know, was that a completely different experience than what you were used to?
It is. Now, granted, you know, I did a little research, you know, I'm going to do some intel before I step out there on the course with him, find out from guys, you know, that have worked for him before, you know, what's up, what, you know, what are the do's and don'ts. But the one thing about him was, you know, he's a little different in that he doesn't want a whole lot of information from a caddy, you know, and there's a lot of caddies that just like to offer stuff. They just can't help themselves. And Chris does not want to hear it. You know, if he wants some information from you, he's going to ask for it. So, honestly, it was one of the easiest jobs I ever had because, you know, other than giving numbers, you know, you're basically just watching golf and encouraging and, you know, supporting and trying to build up his confidence a little bit. But, you know, he's out there making his own decisions. And if he decides that he wants some input from you, then he'll ask you. So, which to me is another good rule of thumb, honestly. I mean, you know, don't speak until spoken to, basically. And I'm not a big believer in offering. If a guy's not asking, then there's no reason for me to offer up unless I see him getting ready to, you know, unless it's kind of a very stressful situation and he's a little bit out of his mind a little bit, and then you're trying to keep him from doing something stupid or making a big mistake. But, you know, these guys are good. They know what they're doing. They didn't get out here, you know, with caddies when they were amateurs. So, you know, it's best to figure out what they need. And because, you know, there's a lot of guys who think they know what everybody needs, and that's just not the case.
Absolutely. Great stuff there from Scott Tway, who's joining us here on the 73rd hole. Now, Scott, I want the full story of the 2014 John Deere Classic. It's Brian Harman's first win as a PGA Tour pro, but it was one hell of a week. Kind of take us through everything that happened that week in 2014 when Brian Harman finally notched his first victory.
Okay, well, so that was kind of, you know, that was a big deal because he had played for, you know, his first two seasons on tour and had some success, but hadn't won yet. And so it was a big goal of his to win. And I think, you know, that kind of played somewhat into the decision of getting me on the bag, having some experience. But so we'd been working hard towards that end. And we get there that week, and Wednesday night, you know, I picked up some sort of stomach bug or something, and I'd been up all night, you know, throwing up and not getting any sleep at all. So I got to work the next day, and I'm not feeling any better, but, you know, you got to go to work. So we get through about six holes, and by that time, he's playing pretty good. He's a couple under, but by that time, I'm having to go to every portal that I could find. I mean, I'm basically giving him numbers. He's hitting it on the green. I'm giving him the putter, and I'm off to try and find a portalette. So I wasn't feeling too good. We get up on the seventh tee box, and he's looking at me and goes, "Scotty, man, you just don't look. We need to get – there was some medic guys over there. We need to get one of these guys to come over and look at you." So one guy, the guys come over, and they look at me, and they're like, "Yeah, you need to get off the course. We need to go get you an IV." I guess my face was white. Wasn't looking too good. So they carted, well, and, you know, I didn't really want to go, but anyway, we, you know, we're like, "Is there anybody here who can go?" And this guy in the crowd, he's standing right there, and he goes, "I can do it." And I remember from reading later, he says, you know, "As long as I don't have to re-putt." But from what I remember him saying was, he said, "I'll shut up and keep up." And when I heard that, I was like, this is our guy right here. So he comes over, and ultimately, you know, his name was Jay Hatch. And he was a high school math teacher who was also a girls' softball coach. He'd won like three state titles with the girls in softball. He's a really good dude, and he just came out there and took over, you know, carried the bag and offered support and did a great job. And so they cart me off to the medic trailer and put an IV in me, and I'm sitting there kind of keeping track of how he's playing and, you know, getting updates from the emergency staff, and they're like, "Well, yeah, he buried this hole. Yep, well, now he's 5 under. And I'm starting to feel a little better after this IV and thinking maybe I can go out. But I'm like, man, there is no way I'm disrupting this round. I said, "Boys, I'm going back to the hotel. You just tell them I'll see you tomorrow." And sure enough, he shoots 8 under. So he's off to the races. And honestly, you know, I start feeling a little better the next day. I make it back out there for the last 3 rounds. But to tell you honestly, I mean, he was on cruise control that week. Nobody was going to beat him. So it was a fun week. His first victory, and it was a lot of fun.
No doubt. So did you hop on the bag Friday once you start feeling better? Did the teacher, did he caddy for the rest of the tournament?
No. I jumped back on Friday. So there we go.
Awesome. Oh, good deal. That's right. I wasn't sure on that one to make sure that you were healthy, but you missed out on a few holes, and he was able to shoot 8 under. So it all worked out for the better, to say the least. And one thing that I'm really curious from you, Scott. I mentioned to you when we had talked earlier in the week, and anyone who listens to the show knows that this is really my biggest fascination point with golf is really, what is the difference between the guys that are able to get out there and make it and have success, and the guys that have so much talent but yet are just fizzle out. And for someone like you who's seen a lot of experience, you've seen the top players in the world, around the Ryder Cups, and your brother as well, and then to go into you've seen kind of middle of the road tour players, you've seen guys that get to the development tour, which now is a Korn Ferry tour, and kind of fizzle out. So kind of break down from your own experience what you've seen is kind of the differences or the characteristics that those individuals have, whether it be mental game or what they do on the course. Do they hit it further? Do they just make more putts consistently? What are the things that you see that separate those guys?
Well, I mean, for me, the biggest thing is confidence, belief, and the want to. And those three things kind of tie in together. But like you say, I mean, the physical ability level, once you get there, is fairly similar. They all have ability. They're all good. But personality wise, some guys are way more driven to succeed than others. And they see a goal and they get fixated on it, and they're not going to deter from it. And those kind of guys are the guys that make it. Guys that are able to, it's almost like tunnel vision. If you're easily distracted by outside stimuli, you're going to struggle a little bit in golf. But if you're, I can remember my brother, I'd go out there before I started caddying for him. I'd go out there and watch him. And he might look right at me while he was out there on the golf course and not even see me because he was so focused. Well, if you're that focused, then you're not noticing, people in the crowd. You're not noticing the situation. You're just playing golf. And it's guys that have the ability to do that, I think, that succeed. And you also, you got to have the want to. You got to really be able to sacrifice. And to play this game on that level, it requires an extreme amount of practice and the love to practice. And that was one of the things that I didn't have when I was growing up. I was more of a social golfer. I like to go out with my friends, have a good time, compete, and play. I love to play, love playing tournaments, but I didn't like to sit out there on the range and beat balls and beat balls and beat balls. And honestly, that's what it takes to get the confidence, to get the repetition, to be able to take it out there in a stressful situation and do it. So to me, that's the biggest thing. It's all in your head.
Yeah, great stuff there. And, Scott, one thing I'm curious about as a caddy who's been around for a long time is now so many of these guys use green reading books. And I'm curious, everybody's always used yardage books, but now you've got these books that have all the little different ridges and slopes and subtle undulations of the greens in them. Is that something that you like to use, that any players you've worked with have liked to use? And how do you feel about that becoming more commonplace in the game of golf?
I don't use one. I have used them. Brian doesn't use one. He has used them. I think if you look at the best putters, it's becoming more and more, but great putters, I don't see them using them that much. I don't see Tiger using it. I think it's a good tool for somebody who struggles to read greens, because, if you get, it's basically telling you where the slope goes. So obviously putts break with the slope. And so if you're having a, trouble determining, you know, especially if the greens are very subtle, where that slope is, then yeah, it's a great tool. And I mean, you'd be silly not to use it if it helped you. I think it's personal, you know, some guys, I remember, Brian was struggling one year at Hawaii. Those greens are pretty flat. The breaks are very subtle. And you know how sometimes you look at a putt and you really don't know. You want to see some break in putt. I mean, you always want to see a little bit of break because everybody knows straight putt's the hardest one, right?
Yeah, and a lot, and, so, you know, and it's a lot of times it's hard to get, you know, in your mind to say, well, there's got to be some break. You know, how can this be dead straight, especially if you know if it's over a, you know, 8 or 10 foot putt or longer?
Right. So if you're looking at a green book and the green book, you know, the putt looks, you can't tell which what it's going to do, and the green book's telling you that the slope's going one way, then you can say, okay, you know, this is pretty straight, but I'm going to play it right center. And because the book's telling me it's going left. And so I suggested to him, because he was having trouble seeing him, I said, well, why don't you try using a green book? And this is a guy who's an unbelievably great natural putter and one of the best long lag putters I've ever seen. And so he's using it, and he's loving it. And, well, the next thing I know, he's in this book, and he can't get out of it. And he's not even looking at the green anymore. All he's doing is looking at this book. And then I'm starting to notice that his feel's getting a little off. And I'm like, oh, whoa, 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 we got to stop. This is not what I intended. This is for you to use if you're unsure, but you're really good at what you do on your own, so you don't want to lose that. So I think that there's some guys that it really helps, because if they are, you know, unconfident about their reads a majority of the time, then yeah, a book like that's really going to help them. But I think great green readers and great putters, I don't think they need it.
Yeah, and go ahead, Scott. I'm sorry.
Yeah, for me, I wish they'd get rid of it. But, you know, it does add value for a lot of people. So if they got rid of it, then it would be harder for everybody, and that would suit me just fine. But I have no problem with it.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question for you, Scott, you know, because there's been a lot of talk about the rules going around, you know, like Brandon Chambly, especially in golf, you know, just all these different people talking about how it's bad for the game, and also how, you know, there's so much pace of play, you know, talk going out there and how it slows things up. So that was going to be my question. I'm glad you answered that. And there was a popular video that went around. I was actually watching it live when it happened, back before the golf was got shut down. Bryson DeChambeau at the Bay Hill Invitational Arnie's Tournament, he had a putt and he missed it by, looked like about a cup up to the left, and he yelled out, "It's a 1.5 degree slope. How can it move that much?" And I'm like, man, and he's gonna. I believe a lot of things he do are gonna transcend to some of the younger generation, which I don't know if it's a good or bad thing. But if I keep hearing a lot more players start saying that stuff, I don't know. Me as a, even though I'm kind of younger, I'm more of a traditionalist in that sense. So it kind of rubbed me the wrong way to hear him yell that out. But I thought it was funny, to say the least.
It is funny, and yeah. I agree with you 100%. I mean, I'm definitely old school, but at the same time, you know, they talk about equipment and all these things, and, you know, changing the game and talk about dialing it back and what have you. But I mean, for me, if you look at the, you know, the earliest days of golf, I mean, that's what those guys did. They were making their own clubs. There were no rules. I mean, if you had a stick with something on the end of it, you could use it to play golf. And so they're trying to create, you know, if you look at all the old clubs, you know, the mashies and these things that look like they were rakes and all kinds of stuff. I mean, they had all kinds of silly stuff, but it was all in the effort to be better at the game, to make the game easier. And so it's part of the history of golf, is trying to make new equipment to help you play the game better. Now, has technology kind of, you know, taken over a little bit? Yeah, but, you know, it's still a pretty darn hard game. And the only sad thing for me about the whole equipment issue is that it's taken a lot of, you know, pretty great golf courses and kind of taking them out of the mix because they're just too short you know, to stand up to these guys. But at that being said, if you look at some of the courses on tour that typically have the lowest winning totals, they're some of the shorter courses. And we're talking about places like Hilton Head, Colonial, and those Innisbrook, Riviera. You know, these are golf courses that were designed so well that it doesn't matter how far you hit the ball. You got to put your ball in position if you're going to play the golf course. And I think that's the bigger issue, not the equipment. I think it's the way they design golf courses now. I mean, you can make them as long as you want, but that doesn't seem to affect the score. What affects the score is how well the course is designed. And I think that's a point people miss a lot.
I completely agree there, Scott. You know, it's you know, like you mentioned, some of these shorter courses can prevail to be some of the harder ones, you know. And we had guest Sam Humphries on a few weeks ago. He was able to go up and play Marion a few years ago, and he said it was the hardest course he had ever played. And it measures, I believe, 6,800 yards or less. So, you know, it's like you said, there's good course design, and, you know, it's just the way that, you know, honestly, it's set up. You know, obviously, U.S. Open has heavy rough. They bring in the fairways a lot. I remember hearing whenever U.S. Open was at Pebble Beach last year, and for the AT&T Championship, they had already sculpted all the fairways in. And last year in the AT&T, the fairway on like one of the holes, I believe it was 16, was almost 20 yards narrower than it was at this year's AT&T Pebble Beach. So, you know, it's just things like that. I mean, you know, if you bring some fairways in, grow a little bit of rough, it's statistically proven that tour players make more putts when the greens are faster. I mean, so if you want to get the scores higher, slow the greens up a little bit, back to how they were when Arnie and Jack had to play, maybe a little different there. But, you know, we'll go down a deep rabbit hole if we do that, Scott. We could talk about that all day. Absolutely. So before we get you out of here, our mutual friend, Riley Cowan, he had sent me over a couple of different tidbits to ask you. One of the stories that I wanted to hear from you, he mentioned that you had an encounter with Bill Murray, and would like to hear about that story. And then if there's any other great stories that you've had out while you've been caddying or playing that you would like to share, feel free to share with the listeners.
All right. Well, I'll tell you the Bill Murray story, and then we can call it a day. But so 97 Western Open, Cog Hill in Chicago. I think Tiger Woods won it that year, but we're playing, and Scott Simpson and Bill Murray were friends, and Bill grew up in Chicago and, you know, is a well-known, huge Chicago sports fan. So he had been there years previous, you know, just watching and spectating, watching Scott play. But this particular year, 97, they decided that he was going to caddy. And so we were fortunate enough to get paired with him. I'm not sure if it was Saturday or Sunday. So we're out there, and you know, he's a blast. I mean, anytime you're around this guy, it's fun because he's just fun. But we're out there, and we're coming off the 12th green, and on Cog Hill, when you walk over to the 13th, the 12th green kind of sits, you know, about even with the fairway, and you kind of got to walk back into the trees to get to the tee box. Well, back then, most of the caddies would just four caddy. You just cut straight across from the 12th green to the 13th fairway. So that's what we did. But Bill had to use the restroom, and there was a portalette back there by the tee box where the players were. So he just set his bag down and walked back to the tee box with the players because he had to go. So I, you know, there's an old caddy trick that we used to use a lot more. Don't see it too much anymore, but it's called strapping a guy. And what you do is you unhook the top hook on the bag strap and then lay it back down so it looks like it's still hooked. And so if a guy's not paying attention, you know, he comes up and picks up the bag and the front end stays on the ground and the back end comes up in the air and all your clubs fall out. So he takes off and he's not around. The bag is just laying there and I couldn't help myself. And there's a bunch of spectators around. So I'm like, y'all be quiet. And I strap him. And I put it down there, and then I walk up the fairway about 50 yards, and I'm sitting on my back and kind of, you know, a little nervous about this because I'm fixing to play a prank on Bill Murray. And so sure enough, he comes trotting back up, you know, reaches down, grabs the strap, real energetic, ready to go, and just yanks on it. And it was absolutely perfect. I mean, it looked like a yard sale. Every club falls out of the bag, spread out on the ground. And this guy did not miss a beat. I mean, he's like looking at the crowd. He's like, who did it? Who did it? And he grabs this guy's drink. It was you. It was you, wasn't it? Grabs his drink, throws it in his face, and he makes a, you know, big, big show out of it. So,
oh, my.
Absolute professional, this guy. He's unbelievable. So I'm just laughing. I'm sitting up there watching this whole thing. It was fantastic. And then I don't know if a fan told him or what, but we're walking up, and somehow he figured out that it was me because we're walking, and he looks at me, and he goes, payback for hell, buddy. So we got a chuckle out of it. It was a lot of fun. So that was my – but I never got paid back yet.
That's what I was about to ask, if he ever did pay you back, because I guarantee it might be something really creative. So he might be waiting for the right time to strike you back.
He might. I've seen him a couple times, and I kind of always want to ask him, like, do you remember that year at Cog Hill? But then again, I'm like, nah, I don't need to remind him.
Right, yeah, you don't want to give him any indication.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. Scott, you've been fantastic. Great stories from all your years around your brother, Scott Verplank, Chris Kirk, and now Brian Harmon. We appreciate you taking the time. We hope to have you back on sometime.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for having me. Anytime. Would love to come back. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, Scott. We appreciate it, my friend.
And that was Scott Tway joining us here on the 73rd hole. Great stuff from Scott. Really appreciate him taking the time out of his day to join Taylor and I on today's 73rd hole. Great guests we've had on the show. Thank you to all of them. Make sure you reach out on Twitter to Taylor and I at Colby J. Powell at @T_Williams101. Search 73rd hole on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Follow those pages. Rate and subscribe wherever you may be listening. We appreciate everyone joining us. We're back next week with more 73rd hole.